Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Community and Regional Affairs Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, March 1st, 2022. Let the record reflect the time is 3:33 p.m. Today we have present Senator Gray Jackson, Vice Chair Senator Rob Myers, and Senator David Wilson, and myself, Chair Hughes. As usual, please silence your cell phone, and I would like also to, not just as usual, but as special, to thank those who help us in our staff, in our committee meeting, Juliana Singh with Senate Record, Leo Steedle with the Legislative Information Office, and our committee aide, Daniel Phelps, from my office. We have one and only one item on our agenda today. We will be hearing Senate Bill 144, an act relating to disaster emergencies, sponsored by Senator Reinbold. Are there any questions prior to beginning the bill hearing? Senator Wilson.
Yeah, just for folks that they wanted to testify. I think they just came in and sat down, but they want to testify. The sign-in sheet's on the corner there.
Except we are not having public testimony today. You're jumping the gun. So, right. And I also will note for the record, if Senator Rob Myers leaves early, it's because he has another commitment. So we won't think it's because he's mad at us, all right? So, all right. So if the sponsor would like to come to the table, did you want your staff to come? Kelly, come on forward. So if you would like to put yourself on the record and introduce your bill, Senator Reinbold.
Thank you, Chair Hughes and honorable members of Regional Community Affairs in the Senate. Thank you very much for hearing us, listening to us, and bringing this important piece of legislation before your committee. My name is Senator Laura Reinbold. I represent Eagle River, Chugiak, Jaybird in parts of Chugiak, and that is District G.
Thank you. And Kelly, why don't you go ahead and put yourself on the record, too?
Thank you, Chairwoman Hughes. Members of the committee, my name is Kelly Toth, and I am Chief of Staff to Senator Reinbold.
Thank you. And go ahead and begin, Senator Reinbold.
Thank you. And I want to, first of all, say thank you, Senator Wilson. A lot of the people from Health and Social Services that Senator Hughes and I are set on, a lot of these people came. They think this bill is equally important as SB 156, so they wanted to come and listen today. So this was great. I feel like I'm competing with the President of the United States, though, with his State of the State right now, and so it really is an honor to be before you guys today, and thank you very, very, very much. So with that, SB 144, it's called Disaster Emergency, an Act Relating to Disaster Emergencies. SB 144, Disaster Emergency, seeks to restore the separation of powers between the executive and legislative branches. During such unprecedented times, the separation of powers is critical to ensuring that all three branches are involved. During the COVID-19 pandemic, the executive branch took broad latitude, declaring disasters consecutively for the same reason, over and over again. They usurped the legislative process, I believe very illegally. SB 144 seeks to ensure when another disaster occurs, if it is needed beyond 30 days, the legislature is included in the process of declaring executive disasters. As you all know, just to refresh your memory, we had SB 241 that was passed, I think, on March 27, 2020. That gave Dunleavy a lot of power through November of 2020. Then he ended up continuing doing disasters November over Thanksgiving, and then again in Christmas, and then he came back again. And we had SB 56, which we defeated in the Senate, and then House Bill 76 came through the House and then ended up in Finance, and then it went directly to the Senate floor. Skipped Senator Wilson, which he was doing a really good job with that House Bill 76. We got some really critical SB 56 with informed consent through unanimously, et cetera. So, and informed consent and the ability to object to the COVID-19 vaccine for any reason. House Bill 76 gave unconstitutional powers to an unelected official, and that's right now Commissioner Kump. I'm not saying good, bad, or indifferent. Him as a person, it just gave him unconstitutional powers. That was asserted through a Supreme Court justice dissent in the OSHA mandate. They basically said you cannot shirk our power, the legislative power, the people's branch power to an unelected bureaucrat. It's our responsibility in the Constitution, education and health. So just very, very important to note that. And we're happy to provide any of the backup. We did just present it to Health and Social Services. But if you would like the OSHA and the specific justices that stated what they stated, we have all that information. In Anchorage, we had a really difficult time. We had massive lockdowns. We had mass mandates. People were essential versus non-essential. The state government, there was 18 mandates. I kept every single one of them and all the health orders. So if anybody wants to see all the originals, I've got them. And there was 18 mandates in Alaska, state mandates that had broad and lasting impacts on Alaska. So we just wanted to make sure that the laws are written in the legislative branch. We are the law-writing branch. And this bill definitely works with all three branches of government in a really cool way. And we just wanted to make sure she's got the sectional, but that's just a very high level of what the bill does. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, why don't we hold questions and go ahead, Kelly, if you would go through the sectional for us, please.
Thank you, Chairwoman Hughes, members of the committee, Kelly Toth, staff to Senator Reinbold. The SB 144 Disaster Emergency Sectional starts with Section 1. It refers to AS 1815-390. It's amended to be adding a new subsection. Before the department takes a public health measure, it ensures that the legislature will approve. Section 2, AS 2210-020, amends adding a new subsection. That the Superior Court is the court of original jurisdiction regarding local state emergency orders, including expedition of challenges heard within 72 hours. Section 3, AS 2620020C, a proclamation of disaster emergency may not remain in effect for longer than 30 days unless extended by the legislature. A proclamation to declare a condition of disaster emergency must state whether the governor proposed to expend the state funds to respond. If the governor issues a subsequent proclamation that is substantially similar, the legislature must affirmatively pass with a two-third vote, approving adopting concurrent resolution ratifying the proclamation of disaster emergency. Section 4 adds a new section, emergency orders that bind, curtail, or infringe the rights of private parties must narrowly be tailored to serve a compelling public health or safety purpose. Each emergency order must be limited in duration, applicability, and scope in order to reduce infringement of individual liberty. Emergency orders that infringe on constitutional rights are limited to 7 days unless the legislature is in session and has 15 days to consider and vote to ratify the order with two-thirds affirmative vote. Or if during the interim, the governor may call the legislature into special session to consider a vote on emergency order. If the 7-day expiration doesn't apply, the 30-day expiration date applies. Each house may vote to ratify or terminate the emergency order and may debate remote debate electronically or by other means to the extent not prohibited by the presiding officer of each house. Emergency order means an emergency order, decree, proclamation, regulation, or other mandate. Section 5, AS 2920 is amended, adding a new section. A municipality may issue a non-binding recommendation and guidelines that do not include provisions for enforcement or surveillance. To the extent that a municipality issues emergency orders, the orders may not infringe on constitutional rights, including rights to travel, work, assemble, and speak, the free exercise of religion, contract and property rights, freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures, and the freedom to purchase lawful firearms and ammunition. That's the completion.
Are there any questions? Senator Wilson.
Yes, Ms. Madam Chair. Thank you. My question is actually on page 2. The issue is really in line 10, and maybe this is a question I see that maybe Ledge Legal is on the line. But it talks about a proclamation, starting on line 8 there, a proclamation of disaster may not retain the effect longer than 30 days unless extended by the legislature by law. And then on the same page, I guess the issue would be on line 21, it talks about the a concurrent resolution, and I thought I had a memo from Ledge Legal saying that a resolution does not have the same effect as a statute and does not have the effect of law. So I guess is that an issue that it should be unless assented by the legislature by a concurrent resolution or by law, which would require a statute. And that was based on the concurrent resolution on an issue that we took up before about our salary commission. We have a memo to that effect.
Would you like to address that, Senator Reinbold? And we do have Ledge Legal on the line.
Let's let Ledge Legal go ahead and take the first, and then I'll make a comment.
Okay. Alex Foote, we see that you're online. And did you hear Senator Wilson's question, or would you like him to repeat it?
I did, Chair. And through the Chair, for the record, this is Alex Foote with Ledge Legal. Senator Wilson, your interpretation is correct that this would require a new bill.
Senator Wilson?
No, that's fine. So we just need to do an amendment or a CS to just fix that language, depending on what the bill sponsor would like to do.
Okay. Thank you. I just want to make a statement in general about this bill, because we've been talking about this bill since spring of 2020 and the need for it. And members may or may not be aware, and those listening may or may not be aware, that concern about disaster statutes were happening across the 50 states by legislatures, whether it was a blue state or a red state, because it was the first real test of an extended period for disaster statutes. And so governors, a lot of legislators realized that the governors were given really extensive powers, and maybe some retooling needed to be done in order to curtail things and rebalance the power where the legislature could weigh in. So it was something that we've talked about needing to do. I'm hoping we can make this work, because we want this to be able to stand up and in the court of law and work for Alaska for the future. And so I do want to make sure, I know it does go to judiciary, but I do want to make sure that the different things in here actually do indeed work, and we can make this. When I think back to when the disaster statutes were written, the idea of having an extended public health situation, I don't think was really part of it. It was thought more for, you know, major fires or an earthquake, et cetera. So it puts a different slant on it. So I hope the sponsor will understand. It's not we're not. I in my questions, I'm not trying to berate anything in the bill. I just want to make sure that this works, so we know if we need to make any fixes. So one of the first questions I have, and Alex, since you are online, I'll ask this of you, just so we understand that first section, I would like to know how this would change how we currently do, because a public health measure, if there's a requirement, right now, it can go for 30 days, and then we'd have to approve in law for it to continue. How does Section 1 change that? Because it seems to say the same thing, must be approved by the legislature by law.
Chair Hughes, so I think that this addresses the possibility that a governor could seek additional disaster declarations based on the same disaster condition. And so this would explicitly state that the legislature would have to approve any further extension.
So that is what number one is referring to, rather than a particular measurement or requirement, because a particular measure or requirement could be simply the Department of Health and Social Services decides it's going to suspend certain regulations for telehealth, for instance. So that's not a full on disaster declaration, that's just one requirement, which I'm my understanding that the term public health measure would include something like that. So we're not indicating that if we're going to lift the regulation on telehealth, that we actually are going to have to convene and pass that, or can he do that during that 30-day period, and it would then expire unless we extend the declaration?
Chair Hughes, that's my understanding, is that it would expire absent express legislative action.
So again, I guess I'm confused because that's our, we're basically saying in Section 1 the way the law already is. Unless you, if this is tying back into the fact that you can't do consecutive orders that are similarly, substantially similar, is it tying into that, the Section 1?
Sure, I might let the sponsor speak to that in terms of her intent.
Okay, Senator Reinbold?
Okay, first of all, I'm going to yield to my staff if you don't mind, and then I'll respond.
Okay.
Kelly Toth, for the record, staff to Senator Reinbold. Section 1 says that before the department takes action on a public health measure, ensures that the legislature approves. And so your question about, or it kind of sounds like it's two separate questions, because one is on the consecutive order issue. That is addressed in a memo from Ledge Legal, I think, that was provided for you, dated January 30th, from Andrew Dunmire on page 2. It says, would a court find the governor's successive declarations to be a violation of AS 2623020 Section C? And the answer from them was yes. A court likely would find that the governor's executive orders declaring new disasters beyond November 15th, 2020, violated AS 2623020C, as discussed above, that the statute gives the legislature and only the legislature authority to extend a disaster declaration.
Okay, and just hold that, because this isn't on the consecutive. This is just about Section 1. Rob, Senator Myers may want to weigh into this, but I just want to make sure, during the 30 days, if something, you know, let's say there's a terrible earthquake and there's not safe drinking water, and so during that 30-day period, the governor issues an order in order to get clean bottled water to a community. We're not saying the legislature has to meet in order for that water to be distributed, are we? What's the intention of Section 1?
So through the chair, Senator Laura Reinbold, and so basically right now in current law, the governor only has 30 days. So Section 1, it's still the 30 days. They suspend regulations and all that, as they do right now. So this is just consecutive. This is the new subject before the requirement of the section. The actual requirement must be approved by the legislature of the law. This is in referring to the extended disaster declarations. And I think it's really important to note that Rob and Senator Meyer and you are both on judiciary as well. And I forgot to put on record that I took information from almost every member of Senate Judiciary and other members in the Senate to come up with this bill. This was going to be a Senate Judiciary bill, committee bill, and so I just want to know that lots of people did weigh into this. And basically what the bill in general is to prevent the abuse of the executive power that we know is rampant across the nation and globally, and this increases legislative sovereignty in general. So I hope that answers it somewhat.
I'm still a bit confused, but I want to hear what Senator Myers has to say. Is it on this point?
Yes, Madam Chair. It's on Section 1 there. So Section 1 referencing 1815-390A, the actions that the public health measures that are mentioned in there really didn't have a whole lot to do with what happened this last time around. They have to do with things like evacuation of an area, decontamination, disposal of human remains, things of that nature. How long do you expect that it would take if we had some sort of a disaster, you know, for example, some sort of a large chemical spill that required evacuation, decontamination, disposal of human remains? About how long do you think it would take the legislature to convene and vote on it?
So that's a good question. I mean, especially being down here in Juneau, I understand that can be difficult. But the way that I read this is that the governor has the authority to do it. This is specifically the department. This is not the governor. This is not, you know, in Section 1, this is just so unelected bureaucrats don't have emergency power. The governor still has the declaration emergency powers for that 30 days. This is before the department. So right now in House Bill 76, that's why I believe Senate Bill 191 actually probably should be rolled into this, because that bill actually strips the unelected bureaucrat from having emergency powers. That's the way that I read this. And if legal can clarify, or if my staff wants to clarify.
Mr. Foote, did you draft this piece of legislation?
No, sure.
Is the person who drafted it available? I'm just really curious why, because it doesn't seem like it's really, based on what the sponsor is saying, it looks like it's pretty similar to what we already have in law, but it's in here for a reason. And is that person available who drafted it?
I'd be happy to check.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Senator Myers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along those lines, if Senator Reinbold, if the legislature is going to have to approve everything before the department does it, before the governor does anything, then why are we not just, instead of inserting this new section, why aren't we simply repealing 1815-390 entirely, and just and so that they don't have those powers delegated to them, so that we would just have to pass a bill?
Okay, through the chair. Through the chair, that is one option. And basically, the goal of this was strictly to allow an elected official to be making the decisions, and this strictly was prohibiting. If you go back and you look at the mandates and the health order, some of the ridiculous things they were saying, for example, were even in the first 30 days, where you could not quarantine in your RV. I just was blown away by some of the craziness that I was reading in the mandates and the health orders. They didn't make any logical sense at all to me. And so bottom line is, this gives broad powers to the executive branch, but when there's specific things, that's what she went over very carefully. It shouldn't be imposing infringements on our liberties. And for example, if you want to quarantine in an RV, you certainly should be able to quarantine in an RV. There was way too broad with what Crum was doing and what Dr. Zink was doing. I was blown away the first 30 days by the mandates. It just, the bottom line is, this just ends up, in general, the bill, if they're going to declare a disaster declaration, needs to stick with 30 days. If they do consecutive, that's where the power of the legislature really comes in, is it's in the subsequent disaster declarations. But you know, if you all think that it needs some adjustments, I am very open, both to his suggestion and to your suggestion. That's why we have these bill hearings. Okay, so this was a year ago we were working on this bill, and I haven't had time to get around to each one of you because of SB 156, but I'm certainly open to suggestions.
You have a follow-up, Senator Myers?
Not now.
But we'll have to think this through, because one of the reasons that the Disaster Act exists in all 50 states is so that there can be a swift response for the health and safety of people in the event of an earthquake, for instance. And so if we're having to call the legislature to convene them, I'm afraid we might put Alaskans at risk at some point. So I think that was the reason of the 30 days. And if we want to have to convene them for every measure. And also, I guess I have another question, and maybe we can address some of this in the Judiciary Committee also. But Mr. Foote, are you still online?
Yes, sure.
Yeah, and I know when you haven't drafted it, it's a tall order to ask you these things, but under the current disaster statutes, we're giving authority to the governor. When a commissioner issues something during that 30-day period, are they acting on the governor's behalf? So is it more or less like the governor signing off on it?
Chair Hughes, that's my understanding, that they're acting pursuant to the governor's power under the Alaska Disaster Act.
Okay, so it seems that there might be a bit of a difference of opinion, Senator Reinbold, because you were talking about unelected officials issuing orders, and Mr. Foote's legal opinion is they're acting under the authority of the governor. So maybe we could tighten things up so that they are perhaps having to go before the governor, so it truly is coming from an elected official rather than an unelected person. Something like that, would that work for you?
Yes, Chair Hughes, that's exactly what the ultimate goal was to make sure that the executive branch elected officials who constitutionally have the authority needs to stay. And that's another reason why I brought up what happened with the OSHA case recently with the NFIB, the National Federation of Businesses, and OSHA, that they said unelected bureaucrats should not be doing laws, period. They just should not be. So it's the legislative branch and elected officials, in particular, the person who has the power, who is our governor. It's one of the most powerful governorships in the nation. And even then, the declarations have gone on. We've been on serial declarations that ended on April 30th of 2021, and we are still in an emergency to this day because Commissioner Crum has kept us from April 30th to this day under an emergency. So currently we are, and when I ask why the Attorney General and the Commissioner Crum is for federal dollars, for SNAP dollars, that is no reason to be keeping us. We'll be in serial emergencies forever. And that's what we're trying to do is confine the executive branch. The legislature should be making laws, and we have a lot of jurisdiction in the Constitution. And I just want to make sure that legislative superiority, and if you look at the Founding Father documents, that it is honored. And it's not. A lot of our authority has been usurped, and I'm just trying to get it back into the lane of the elected officials and the legislature. But I'm very open to some suggestions.
And I think because this was a public health situation, we're very cognizant of things coming from the Department of Health and Social Services. But let's think to step back and think about other types of disasters, and let's go back to an earthquake, for instance. So we might have a DOT commissioner in that instance making decisions. And so would the sponsor, if we want anything that the HESC commissioner might wish to require, would we want other commissioners for other types of disasters also for that to be signed off for the governor? Is that something the sponsor would be interested in entertaining?
Yeah, bottom line is we just want to make sure, once again, that the elected officials are the ones that have the constitutional responsibility, and, of course, they would be working, you know, with the administration, but just to ensure there's just a lot of administrative law and the mandates, the health mandates, cause tremendous impacts across the state. And I just 30 days is what the state statute says now. We just want to keep it in that state statute the way that is, and subsequent disaster declarations, because we're the closest to the people, that we should be making sure that our stamp of approval as the legislature is on there. And I believe my staff had something to say. Did you? Sorry, your pen was waving. So, okay.
Well, I just think we might need some clarification with that, because right now it kind of looks like even during that 30-day period, the legislature would have to quickly convene. And so we're not saying that. So that might be a point. And if the committee aide could take notes on these kind of things that as we look to work on it. Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Reinbold, last I checked, the HESC commissioner, as well as I believe all the other commissioners, serve at the pleasure of the governor. If they were doing something he didn't want, wouldn't he just fire them?
Yes. Through the chair. Okay, through the chair. You know, that's basically what it would appear. But I think it's very, very important that in House Bill 76, even the Supreme Court of the United States of Alaska said you should not be giving power to unelected bureaucrats. So I think in this case, that's why I have SB 191, which I do think needs to be companion with this bill. It's so important to make sure that it goes back, you know, into the power of the governor. But, you know, of course, they do serve at his pleasure. So, yes, of course, they can let him go if they want to.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Senator Myers.
So effectively what you're trying to say with this bill is that you want the governor to micromanage what his commissioners are doing? Is that what you're saying here?
Through the chair. Basically, we just want to make sure that a commissioner doesn't get power that is not constitutional. We want to make sure that the powers in the Constitution that are for the governor are not pushed aside. He just needs to take on it. For example, this emergency declaration that is going on right now, I do not believe anywhere in the Constitution where it gives an unelected bureaucrat, in this case an appointed person, the power to declare an emergency, and that is what is happening. There is abuse of power. I'll say it just like it is. That is going on right now.
Okay. I want to move on to Section 2 where it talks about the courts, because I'm noticing that Nancy Mead has called in, and I want to take advantage of her being with us today to ask about Section 2 and any comments that you might have, Ms. Mead, about how we might make this workable. As I don't know if you were on earlier when I stated, across the country, legislatures are working to improve their disaster statutes based on this extended period. And so we would like you to weigh in on your thoughts about Section 2, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. Section 2 would be, as far as I can tell, fairly unique in our statutes, in that it would require the court to expedite consideration of challenges to the lawfulness of these orders. And I will say that the statement on page 1, line 12 to 13, that the court would need to hear challenges such as these within 72 hours of being filed would be somewhat challenging for the court to implement and apply. Because I'm not really clear from the wording of Section 2 what it means that the court, that these challenges shall be heard within 72 hours. I don't know if that means they need to be decided. I don't know what happens if all the parties have not fully briefed the issue, whether the court still needs to hold a hearing. I think the fact that it says within 72 hours of being filed presents some challenges with respect to scheduling. For example, if something is filed on a Friday afternoon, it's not clear to me that how the court would act within 72 hours in any meaningful manner on one of these challenges. I also just...
Before you go on from that point, what would be workable, and you have suggested for better wording to clarify that?
Through the chair, or to the chair, I'm not sure exactly what the goal is, except to kind of get it resolved right away. But I don't. There aren't other statutes that tell the court system to prioritize certain cases at the appellate level. There are several rules of appellate procedure about expedited appeals, for example, in election redistricting cases or in cases involving children. There may be wording that I could think of that say the court shall handle it with, you know, in the normal course or something like that. But I think it is fairly unusual for the statute to say that a case of that sort that's challenging one of the orders, that the court needs to hear it before, for example, a children's case or some other emergency type of case. So that is just a little bit unusual.
And you don't have to do it on the fly here, but think about it. If the committee agrees that we don't want these to drag out and we want it to move at a good pace, if you could think of some way in any language there that might help it, a child in need of aid, those are very serious cases. We probably shouldn't be bumping that. But a way that we're sure that we know that something like this wouldn't drag out for weeks, if you could please work on a suggestion of how we can do that to make this work, I think the sponsor might be amenable to something like that. In the weekend situation, maybe we need to allow for weekends, that kind of thing. Senator Reinbold, did you have something to say?
I did, and I want to say thank you, Chair Hughes. We did put that in as a space holder, and we understand we might need to say excluding holidays, excluding weekends, and things like that, and I think we actually spoke about this. But I think that this is important. When emergency orders are going, when there's one potential case in the entire state, one potential case, when we were declared an emergency, people were told to run and hide in their houses, that we were in lockdown mode. when schools are being closed, when state facilities are being closed, when churches are, there's massive restrictions on churches that completely violate constitutional rights. This is an issue. This impacts almost every Alaskan. And so these are issues of critical, critical importance. And this health response that we've had over 2 years, has it really created better health? Not what I'm seeing out in the community, not what I'm hearing, not what I just heard in health and social services. The mandates have created tremendous harm, unprecedented, and we may never, ever recover from them. So I do believe that if it is impacting broad and wide Alaskans, the bill was trying to focus on legislative, you know, boosting up the legislature, reducing some of the executive power, and also getting the jurisdiction, courts are around all our community, that we ended up, they're a really good place for discrepancies between, you know, the people and the executive branch. It was just a good place for them to be able to say, no, this is unconstitutional. You can't shut the churches down. You can't shut the schools down. They're to be open for the children, you know, constitutionally. That's the reason we chose the space holder. We're happy to work with Nancy Mead in regards to, you know, something that might be a little bit more reasonable in time. We knew that was going to be a trigger, 72 hours. We knew it, and we're glad for the discussion.
So we will look forward to hearing from you, Ms. Mead. I also wanted to ask you about the strict scrutiny, and can you explain what that means, and is that also how we should be looking at this? And if you have anything else about Section 2, this is your chance to let the committee know what you're thinking.
Thank you to the chair. Again, Nancy May, General Counsel for the Court System. The strict scrutiny standard of judicial review is a more or less well understood legal doctrine that courts use to look at whether government action that discriminates against a protected class, such as if the government takes an action that allegedly discriminates against somebody based on their race, religion, national origin, when the court is determining whether that's okay or not, there's a certain test that they apply. So the strict scrutiny, it's part of usually equal protection and things like that, means that in order for the government to go ahead with this discrimination or purported discrimination against a protected class, the government must have a compelling state interest to take that action. And there are different standards, and the government action must be narrowly tailored to achieve that result. So I don't know if I really am.
I would ask then, when you're talking about during lockdowns and you're telling churches they can't meet, it sounds like strict scrutiny would be appropriate then. Would you agree?
Well, to the chair, it depends on exactly what the challenge is. I'm not clear that a challenge to the lawfulness of a state order would cover everything that order might require. I certainly hear you with respect to something that involves action that applies to a religious group, such as a church, and typically strict scrutiny does coincide with potential case alleging discrimination against one of those protected classes. And the narrow tailored, which is also in this bill, is something that goes along with that. So that is a sort of a well understood legal concept to use strict scrutiny for cases that call for it under the equal protection analysis. Madam Chair, I would love to just make one more comment about Section 2 that does give me a little bit of concern, and that is I'm unclear from the beginning of this section whether just anybody can file a lawsuit challenging the lawfulness of a state in local emergency orders. All this Section 2 says is the Superior Court is where it would occur, but I'm very unclear on whether, for example, there might be 50 lawsuits filed the day after a disaster declaration in 50 different courts, and all of those would need to be heard within 72 hours. So I'm struggling to find the, basis for somebody filing. It isn't just the legislature filing, but it seems perhaps anybody. And so I would worry about that potential.
Well, thank you for that. Let's pause for a moment, let the the sponsor respond to that to see if we could, because I think that cases would need to come before the court. We need a workable way it could happen, and I could see where it'd be rather overwhelming. And you say 50, what if it's 150? So, Senator Reinbold, how did you envision this?
Okay, so first of all, anybody can file a lawsuit at any time right now. I can tell you I'm in the middle of a lawsuit right now, and it is extraordinarily time-consuming, extraordinarily expensive, and it would be highly unlikely that there would be 50 lawsuits, you know, in a snap of a fingers. I mean, I think theoretically it could be a municipality. It could be something like that. But just to think that, I think it's very highly unlikely. Look at how many people are suffering across the state right now, and they've been unable to find a lawyer for a variety of reasons. They've been unable to file their cases, and they're suffering at unprecedented levels from what I've seen living here far over 50 years at this time. So I will say that I think that is unlikely, but I do believe people do already anybody can file a lawsuit. I mean, I literally made a lawsuit for blocking somebody for 24 hours. That's it. And it's cost me almost $60,000 to fight this. This person was harassing me and my followers, and I gave them a warning and banned. So I'm just saying, it's extremely expensive. I think it's very, very unlikely that would happen. But it, as it stands right now, people can do it already.
Ms. Mead, you know, on different cases, I'm thinking of the redistricting case. There were numerous filers, and then it was kind of all assembled and considered at once. Is if individuals were to file, and I actually think, especially because we've been through this once, and people maybe, quote unquote, have had it. If there were, let's say, another lockdown, I could see that you could have quite a few people that would file. Just so, Ms. Mead, if you had various people filing on the same subject, can they be pooled like the cases were with the redistricting?
To the chair, sometimes that can happen. The parties generally agreed, if I'm not mistaken, in the redistricting case. They were all filed in the same court in Anchorage, for example, which might not be the case with a statewide emergency declaration. And they all were represented by attorneys. And even though their arguments weren't the same, they sort of had something to do with each other. So, but for example, under this, and I'm just hypothetically saying, somebody could sue in Sitka about a vaccine problem, somebody could sue in Palmer about a church problem, somebody could sue in Barrow about the inabilities to subsistence hunt, and outside of the same judicial district, it would not be feasible to combine cases. And I can see people also doing this without an attorney, because of course you don't have to have an attorney, in which case those would be, you know, just they take a lot more time for the court system and might be a little bit more difficult to handle.
Well, as Alaskans, we do have a right to file and challenge things, so we're going to have to figure that out. So, Nancy, you've got a task on that on Section 2, and we'll be interested to hear your feedback to have a workable Section 2. Senator Wilson has a question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hamid, the 72 hours, could we draw something up similar to the Title 47 72-hour rules of how to engage and set up guidelines for that? Would that be similar for this, or would that work?
Through the chair to Senator Wilson, I believe you're referring to, for example, an involuntary mental commitment. Under Title 47, and those, yes, the court must have an initial hearing within 72 hours. Those are handled by our magistrates, by and large, who work nights and weekends. We do staff 24 hours in order to accommodate emergencies such as that. It's not clear to me that a constitutional challenge, which is what this would be something that would be handled by a magistrate judge, as opposed to this Section 2, which says it would be handled in the Superior Court. And I am aware that Superior Court jurisdiction can be delegated to magistrates in certain circumstances, and I could think about that, whether it's something that would be handled on an emergency basis. One difference that I'll point out is that those emergency mental commitments are, they typically involve a number of professionals at the hearings, including the attorneys and doctors and psychiatrists and others. And so, again, I can imagine that the hearings under this Section 2 may not involve the same sort of parties who do this sort of thing every single day. But that is a thought.
Follow up, Senator Wilson? All right. I'm going to look at Section 3. And this is when we're talking about consecutive. Oh, Senator Reinbold, you had a comment on that.
Thank you very much, Chair Hughes. I just wanted to say that when churches are being virtually shut down, you know, 15 people or whatever they were allowed to do, I mean, even in some of the health orders, I wish I had them before me right now, but they were saying how you could do an Easter basket, how you could park your car, how you could interact with the clergy. This was Easter. This happened right before Easter. This had a profound impact on me, I'll tell you. And that's why I keep health mandate. Go read health alert number 10 and 11. Dramatic impacts on my life personally. I saw churches. I left my church based on how they decided to go ahead and go along with this government intrusion in my mind. And it really has impacted me. But when churches are being virtually shut down, when schools are being shut down, private and public, that's impacting parents at a dramatic level. You know, now they have to rearrange their entire lives. When people are told who is essential and who is not, and the essentials have more rights than the non-essentials, and to me, a whole massive amounts of lawsuits would be awesome, because then it would show the abuse of power of the executive branch and likely would correct actions immediately, even with the threat of a lawsuit. So I don't think it's a bad thing to have tons and tons of lawsuits. I do think maybe we need to change, you know, the amount of time. I'm willing to work in regards to that. But I think it would show massive overreach, which has happened. And I just wish there would have been more lawsuits sooner. To be honest with you, we wouldn't be in this horrific state of recovery that we're in, that many may never recover from at this point in time. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. So looking at Section 3, this is the section regarding consecutive declarations being declared. And I'm going to ask Mr. Foote, as far as the various, and Senator Reinbold referred to it in her opening comments, that there was, legally, it was not correct to be issuing proclamation after proclamation. Would you agree with that, Mr. Foote?
To the chair, Senator Hughes, I would not.
What you would say, it was legal or it was not legal for the governor?
My understanding is that the governor's declarations have followed the law as it currently stands.
Because they were for different COVID strains, is that how it was determined? Mr. Foote?
Yes, to the chair, Senator Hughes, I wish I could answer with more specificity at this point, but all I can what I can tell you is that it's the opinion of my office that those emergency declarations were lawful under AS 2623020.
And I remember seeing a legal opinion that they weren't, so I'm kind of surprised at that. And I'm going to go to Senator Reinbold in a minute, but first, Senator Wilson.
Yeah, Mr. Foote, was that before or after the legislature codified them by passing the disaster declaration statute?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I don't know.
So I have a memo here dated January 30th, 2021, where it said the question was, would a court find the governor's successive declarations to be a violation of AS 26.23.020C? And the legal memo says yes. a court likely would find that the governor's executive orders declaring new disasters beyond November 15th violated the law. So, Alex, if there's something else that's been written other than that, if you could please provide it to my office and we'll provide it to members. Senator Reinbold, you wanted to say something about that?
That's exactly, Madam Chair, that I was going to be referring to, that this was from Andrew Dunmar on January 30th, 2021, and they said, yes, the court would likely find it that a governor's executive orders by declaring disasters beyond November 15th did violate AS 26-23-02-OC. As discussed above, the statutes gives the legislature and only the legislature authority to extend disaster declarations. So
Senator Myers.
Statute.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I tend to agree with both yourself and with Senator Reinbold that the disaster declarations as issued were illegal according to the current statute. My question is, effectively, if they were, it's a question of enforcement. If they were illegal, then they needed to have been addressed either by a vote of the legislature disapproving them or by a lawsuit, and neither of those happened. With the new changes created here, we end up with in Section 3, we end up with the same problem. It still would require either a vote of the legislature or a challenge in the court. So it doesn't seem to help the situation. We're stuck in the same problem.
Senator Wilson, I'll go to Senator Reinbold.
Yeah, I think that, what was it, Senate Bill 56 had the effective dates that backdated and that gave authorization. So technically the legislature did take action after the point. And so the legislature made those current declarations thus legal after we voted upon that piece of legislation and gave those retroactive effective dates, is my understanding from Ledge Legal.
And I have a bit of question about that, because during that period before that occurs, you're actually in an illegal state. So that doesn't seem like very good. We're going to have, so part of this is a substantially similar definition. And so that's one of the things I want to better understand. Mr. Foote, do we have a definition in statute for substantially similar?
To the chair, Senator Hughes, my understanding is that we do not.
We do not. Okay. Is that language used elsewhere in statute?
It is, to the chair, Senator Hughes, it is legal language that's used, but to my understanding, it's not used in this context.
So just thinking this through, when you have, in this case, a COVID situation and you have various strains, some would argue that it's all COVID, so they're all substantially similar, and someone would try to say, no, they're different strains, so they're not. So I think that is something that we're going to have to sort out. Another question I have, thinking, what if a disaster overlaps two different governors? So one governor's ending his or her term, new governor's coming in, beginning his or her term. So when the way this is written now, Mr. Foote, is it referring to one individual as governor, or could two different governors have two different declarations? Let's just use COVID as an example, because they're not the same person.
To the chair, Senator Hughes, I'm a little reticent to answer that based on discussion of this memo, which I'm looking up now on our database. If you would give me a moment, perhaps answer that.
And just while you're doing that too, I do think that's something we can work with the sponsor on, because if we're not going to let one governor issue multiple substantially similar proclamations, I don't think that we should have a new governor be able to repeat without legislative approval emergency proclamations that are substantially similar to one that was just ending. And would that be the intent of the sponsor?
Chair Hughes, yes, that I believe is the intent of the law itself. It basically, what this Section 3 does is it prevents abuse of power, which we all know, it's been a real concern over the last 2 years. And I am not a fan of ex post facto law, just going back and saying, oh, you were very illegal, you were unconstitutional, and now let's just go back. And that's why I fought SB 56, which we did defeat in the Senate. You know, then it came back through the House. I still think that is an unconstitutional law, and that's why I have 191. The only part of SB 241 that is still in place is that section that gives Crum the ability to declare emergencies. And again, I feel like it's unconstitutional, so probably should have been part of it. We did divide it out, but the intention is to follow the current law. The current law has been declaring disaster declarations should be 30 days.
You know, and one of the challenges, and it is what it is, because we have a capital that is separated from so much of the state that it's very difficult for the legislature to convene. And you think that November 15th expiration, it was around Thanksgiving time, and then you had the holidays, and getting the legislature to convene and make the decision to do that, that was not happening. And one of the things that I wish that we could just write in statute that the legislature would have the ability to vote electronically. Unfortunately, the uniform rules would have to be suspended and action would have to be taken on that. So we can't just write it in the bill and say that the legislature can meet electronically. So we do have an extra hurdle, I think, to overcome. And I'm wondering if the sponsors, the sponsor staff, have looked at what other states have done about that, because I think they have similar things where the legislature has to re-up things. And I know a lot of other states moved to the ability to vote electronically. Did they also have to hit that high hurdle to suspend uniform rules, or were they able to do it statutorily?
Did you research?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, staff to Senator Reinbold, Kelly Toth, I would need to research that and get back with you on that, because we can't.
Because I think just thinking out loud here, one way we could do it is we could, because we can't grant the authority to vote electronically in the statute, we could have something that it kicks in once the rules are suspended. And, you know, we probably need a rule in the uniform rules that applies to disasters so that you don't have to fly everyone in, because it's kind of a, I'm not sure how we can fix it at this point. And as you know, the Senate voted to suspend its rules to do that, but the House did not do it. And we could not do it unless both bodies agreed. And it takes a two-thirds vote to do that, which is a high bar. Senator Reinbold?
Well, I wanted to say, first of all, I think it's an excellent idea. I think the Senate was on the right page in regards to that. And there's no other capital that I know of, I mean, with the exception possibly of Hawaii, where people have to fly, you know, to get to the Capitol. So we are in a very, very unique situation. Most people can just drive within an hour or a couple, you know, it depends, maybe a dozen hours for really large states. But the bottom line is I do think we need to have that in place to be able to remote or at least meet quickly. We need good leadership. We need strong leadership in order to do this for things that are impacting. I don't think most people, and it's taken me a long time through a lot of listening sessions and hundreds of hours of going out into the community, realizing the negative impacts that the disaster declarations have had, the serial disaster declarations, and even the current one is having broad negative impacts. So I wish there would have been more lawsuits. I was one that was involved in trying to bring a bunch of lawsuits forth, and I've you know helped with ASD ones and municipality ones and things like that. But the problem with Alaska, and I'm going to be a little bit blunt right now, a lot of people like to be part of the 300 or so Department of Law lawyers. A lot of them have aspirations to become, because I've interviewed a ton of lawyers the last 2 years. A lot of them have aspirations to become judges. A lot of them love the outside counsel, the extremely lucrative outside counsel. They like the municipal jobs. We have the largest that I'm aware of law per capita, the number of lawyers that are employed by government, that the private sector really gets the short end of the stick right now. And I've personally even been finding that, trying to get people to stand up and fight, and that the costs are astronomical to hire lawyers. And so I do wish this would have been resolved in the courts, but I certainly understand why it has not, knowing the motives of a lot of, and a lot of them are afraid of the media, and they're afraid of the government, And they're also, they wanted COVID, you know, the COVID-19 money. That has been a huge, huge, huge issue. The massive amounts of hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars that have been distributed with COVID money has been a very, it has deterred a lot of people from going into the courts as well. So there's been a lot of things, you know, been involved here, but it's been very, very hard for freedom fighters. I thought lawyers were going to be the ones that were saving this, the state and fighting for individual liberties, because they should all know the Constitution and that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and that if we don't have that constitutional liberties, then we don't have the republic, you know, that we all serve. And I just think it's critical that we're here to defend individual liberties, and I'm just personally asking lawyers to step it up, because they need to out there. A lot of them have ducked out from this critical fight to defend individual liberties, and that's why, you know, right now we're just having the legislature step it up, and that's basically, it's to stop abuse of power by the executive branch that everybody knows is rampant across the nation, with probably one exception, and that's two. South Dakota and Florida have been unbelievably free, and that's who I'm competing with. I'm trying to make Alaska the freest state in the nation, so we can have an economic boom, and that's my ultimate between SB 44. SB 191 and SB 156. That's what the ultimate goal is, to protect individual liberties and get one of the biggest economic booms that we've ever seen in the state of Alaska, because Florida's taken a lot of thunder right now economically, and I think we could use that right now in Alaska.
Okay. One of the things, and the bill is pretty involved. This is obviously an important thing, and it has long-term effects on future governors, future legislatures, future critical disaster situations, and will impact lives. So I want to get this right, and I do know it's going to the judiciary. The sponsor has requested that, you know, we work hard on it as a committee and to get it in a form that is in pretty good shape. And so I do want to honor that, because I have the luxury. I'm really interested in this, and so we aren't going to rush this bill, and we are coming up on our time, and there's more to discuss, but one thing on page 3 I wanted to ask, as we talk on line 10 about an emergency order expires in 7 days, and I just want to understand, because earlier we were talking about orders that could last for 30 days, and then the legislature would have to re-up them. Now we're talking about something that lasts in for 7 days, so I would like, and I believe that it at the top of the page, we're talking about emergency orders that bind, curtail, or infringe the rights of private parties. And so how that might be determined compared to something else that might be ordered. And I would like to see what Ledge Legal has to say about line 10 on page 3, an emergency order as compared to the other orders, the other measures, mandates that the governor could do for 30 days. Could you speak to that, please, Mr. Foote?
To the chair, Senator Hughes, the governor's power to declare these mandates comes from the legislature, and so it's within the legislature's power to narrow the scope of that through this legislation. In terms of the constitutional impacts, that would be determined by a court, and then the court would have to determine whether there was a sufficient government interest to infringe on those individual rights.
So can you give some examples of measures that would work for the 30-day limit versus the one that would be for 7 days, Mr. Foote?
To the chair, Senator Hughes, I'm not sure I follow the question.
So, remember when we were talking about Section 1 and the sponsor indicated that the governor could still issue orders for 30 days and then the legislature would have to decide whether to approve their continuance or not. So that we're talking about orders that could be issued for 30 days. On page 3, we're talking about orders that would expire in 7 days. Could you please give me an example of a couple that could go for 30 and ones that you think that would fall under the 7-day rule?
To To the chair, Senator Hughes, I'm sorry, I'm not sure that I follow other than to say that, well, I guess the legislature could narrow it to 7 days if they wanted to, but are you requesting, like, what specifically, what type of order could be limited to 7 days versus 30?
Yes. Normally it's 30, but on page 3, line 10, we're talking about emergency orders that would expire in 7.
To the chair, Senator Hughes, I'm sorry. I'm not sure, but I'd be happy to get back to you in writing if the committee wishes.
And so I'll ask that of the sponsor. Maybe you could give examples of what would fall under that 7 versus what would fall under the 30 days.
Well, first of all, through the chair, Laura Reingold, Senator Laura Reingold from District G. First of all, I'm just going to speak to that section in general. And actually, I just found something that needs to be changed. That's what this committee work is about, working out the technical issues in there. So there's something that I actually see that I don't like. But anyway, this is emergency orders that bind, curtail, or infringe on the rights of private parties must be narrowly focused to serve a compelling health interest or safety purpose. Each emergency order must be limited in applicability and scope in order to reduce and infringe on individual liberties. The next line is what I'm going to change. But basically what it says, that any emergency order that infringes on the right to travel, to go to work, to assemble, to speak, to exercise free religion, anything with property rights, freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures, the freedom to purchase lawful firearms and ammunition, anything that infringes on those guaranteeing constitutional rights must expire within 7 days. I mean, I would say they can't do it at all in an emergency. It's technically in martial law that that's allowed. So this actually needs some cleaning up language in regards to this section. But for example, a church. The church is what we've been told is about 50% of people don't church that they did pre-COVID. This has dramatically impacted people's religion and the ability to assemble. It's businesses. As you know, I have not gotten the total number, but lots of businesses have been shut down. People were told who is essential, who is not. Greater than 7 days, people could lose their livelihoods over this. And that's the reason we put the 7 days in, because these mandates, people weren't even thinking that we're doing these, of the dramatic and long-term and life consequences that have had on people. And so that's why this is just a warning. Please think about what you're doing. Don't be so cavalier, like this doesn't matter. It did matter. And some children will never recover because of the impacts to their education. Businesses will never come back. Churches might never, I hope to God not, but might never recover from the dramatic losses. And that's why I think this bill is just so doggone important, is it empowers the legislative branch. It gets the courts involved quickly, and it keeps the executive branch that needs to be kept in check. And that, in essence, is what the bill does.
I think what might be helpful, and I'm going to give you a homework assignment, because I think what the committee needs, and we can use the past 2 year period, is a list of the various orders that were issued, the requirements, and then maybe mark the ones that you think would go under the 30-day and those that you would go under the 7-day. And we'll have to sort this out, because then we're hitting this difficulty with the capital being hard to access, and how we would deal with something that, you know, 7 days, and, you know, we're still, we know COVID was, it wasn't like some previous horrible pandemics in world history where just whole communities were dying. It wasn't to that extent, but let's imagine that there was one that people were just in every home, people dying. So perhaps something would need to go beyond 7 days. And how are we going to handle that if we can't get the legislature in Juneau? So it's pretty challenging. I'm thinking, because of that, we probably, and maybe with Hawaii, have the most challenge of all because of that. But at this point, unless there are other questions, I'll let you make a closing comment. We haven't quite got through all the discussion about the municipality. I'm guessing Senator Gray Jackson is always our one person very interested in things that we're asking municipalities. So we'll save that for the next hearing. But I ask members to comb through this, because it doesn't matter what party we're from, it, you know, and you're going to have changes and who's in the majority and who's in the minority and who's in the governor's mansion. We want this to work for our state, and we need to come together and rebalance the power that we have here and think about it in a different kind of way when these statutes were first created, that were really intended for more isolated, short-term kind of thing. So now we're thinking, having gone through what we've gone through, we realize that there's something, other things we need to think about. So Senator Reinbold, if you want to make a closing statement, we will set the bill aside for now while we continue to work on it.
Actually, Madam Chair, Senator Reinbold, bottom line, I don't want to make a closing comment to this, because this is going to be an ongoing topic, and I'm willing to talk and work.
I mean,
with
closing for the day.
Okay, for the day.
Overall.
Bottom line, we're happy to make that list that you requested in regards to the 18 mandates and the health alerts, the health. We'll be happy to do that as an examples of how big and how broad they were. And then we're even willing, we even kept all the municipal ones as well. So we're happy to do that, the ones that impacted. So, yes, and I did want to also bring you to one section of the bill. On page 3, it said each house may ratify or terminate an emergency order C of this section by remote debate, electronic or other means as established by the uniform rules. So you're right, we do need to address the uniform rules, but we did address the applicability of this in state statute. So the bottom line is we do think, and we're super thankful for the Senate and the ability for the Senate that did suspend the rules. We were more progressive than the House in regards to dealing with this issue. And with that, I want to say thank you, guys. This is hard. This is a tough bill. It's a tough situation. What we're trying to do is empower the legislature, get the courts involved, like we said, and it's our duty to protect and defend individual liberties. And just in case anything like this does ever happen again, which it may, then we don't have an out-of-control executive branch. That's what we're trying to prevent. So with that, thank you very much for listening. Really appreciate it.
Are there any closing comments from members? Okay. Well, thank you very much, Senator Reinbold and Kelly, for bringing forward what is the bill number? SB 144, I think it is. Is that right? Yes, SB 144, disaster emergencies. So I think until I'm not going to set an amendment deadline until we get all the way through it and get more of our questions answered. Then we can work together and figure out how to move forward. So our next meeting is tentatively scheduled at 3:30, but we will be in touch with you to confirm or cancel that meeting on Thursday. And seeing no other remarks or having no other business to come before us, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 4:46.